Finally, some stability at the top of the Premier League. Leicester, Manchester City, Arsenal went into the weekend holding the league's top three spots, and they'll reach the league's next round in those same positions. Thank God for the FA Cup. We'll touch on that competition's fourth round briefly, and we'll also talk about the transfers that have gone through this weekend as the winter window's final days approach. Welcome, everybody, to the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll get to that preview in the second half of the show, but as I welcome my co-host, Kartik Krishnayar, into the pod, we're a few hours removed from some major news. John Terry, one of the best defenders in the Premier League's short history, revealed that Chelsea does not intend to offer him a contract for next season. Over his two-plus decades in Chelsea's academy and first team, well, those days will come to an end in May. Kartik, what were your first thoughts when you heard that news?
That it was bizarre and that there must be some sort of money-related issue here, because I think what we're seeing is that Chelsea has trimmed their squad, the size of their squad. They're using, obviously, the loan system to recoup a lot of finances. Now, part of that is financial fair play, but they're not quite as deep as they've been in the past. They're not quite as top-heavy as far as player salaries. And we've seen them actually plummet in the Deloitte Money League now down to 7th or 8th, where they at one point were 3rd or 4th in that. So I'm not saying that Roman Abramovich is having major financial worries, but I think that they're being much more prudent in how they spend money. That having been said, they're not re-signing JT when they've re-signed Ivanovic. That is kind of strange.
That is interesting. And I think it's kind of a comeback for those people that are merely going to say this is performance related. Of course, there's an age issue there between the two. But even if it's performance related, I find it hard to believe John Terry wouldn't be one of the team's best four or five defenders next year, unless they're really going to go out and spend a lot of money in the summer. Who knows? It's Chelsea. They could definitely do that. I think it's a bit sad. John Terry, of course, is somebody that has a very mixed history on the field. He's been one of the better, not just defenders, but players in the Premier League era, certainly one of the most decorated non-Manchester United players in the Premier League era, but off the field has definitely divided followers between fans and people who don't really like Chelsea. What do you think of his future, Kartik? It seems like at 35, 36 years old, it might be a good time to do as Jamie Carragher did and just retire.
It might be. That's an option. He could go to China. That's an option. Mm-hmm. He could go to the Middle East. He could go to Major League Soccer. We've seen his former teammate, Ashley Cole, former defensive line partner, Ashley Cole, just signed with the Los Angeles Galaxy this week on a very low salary contract, by the way. Ashley Cole is not a designated player in Major League Soccer. He's taking the salary of basically an American journeyman veteran player.
Yeah, something that is very confusing to people outside of Major League Soccer circles, because they just assume that the only reason Ashley Cole would come here is if he's getting millions of dollars to do so.
Right. So Ashley Cole is actually making less money than several American players who our listeners may not have heard of, quite honestly, unless you follow Major League Soccer and the U.S. men's national team closely. So that is that possibility. But there's also the possibility of potentially playing on the continent in Italy, maybe.
Italy seems like a good fit, though.
Yeah,
Italy,
I don't think France. He could play in. Yeah, I don't think he could play in Germany or Spain at this yeah. point in his career. So maybe Italy for a season. I don't know that he'd want to do that, though. I think the options would probably be the U.S. or China or going into commentary.
Some people might say Zenit St. Petersburg would be a good fit for him. We'll probably have a few more months to consider John Terry's legacy, but it is going to be 5 months to consider. This is a person that has been as good as any other player in the Premier League, and much like Steven Gerrard's departure at Liverpool last year, definitely an end of an era, no matter what you think about the player. As for the rest of the news this weekend, they largely centered around the FA Cup. We're not going to dig deep on it, but we are going to talk about some things that can influence the Premier League going forward. In the fourth round, which took place this weekend, the only Premier League teams to fully bow out were Aston Villa and Stoke, Villa losing at home 4-0 to Manchester City, while Stoke actually gave up a goal to Crystal Palace, losing at Selhurst Park. Not surprisingly, they didn't score a goal. As for other matters, we have a couple of teams going to replays. West Ham and Liverpool will go to a replay. West Brom could not win at home against Peterborough. But as far as the rest of the results, Kartik, I think a few points stand out. Manchester United on Friday got the round kicked off at Derby, scored 3 goals, which is an incredible rarity for Manchester United. And just on the surface, I think they are improving a little bit in attack.
Yeah, certainly a better performance than they gave against Sheffield United a third-tier side in the previous round at Old Trafford. Derby, it should be noted, is in a free fall in the championship, and they Mel Morris, their new owner, is going to have to make some decisions at the end of the season. They have a very bloated squad by championship standards in terms of salary, and they might have to break that thing up because I don't think they're getting promoted. The thing I would say about United is I'm not sure they're really improving. I think Wayne Rooney is getting back to his form and giving us some nice Rooney moments. And Rooney is one of the best players in the history of this league. But I'm not sure I'm seeing a whole lot from the rest of the United squad to indicate that beyond Rooney returning to his natural level, because he was in a massive funk for several months, that this team has actually gotten better.
You know, Rooney's annual funk. Somebody that doesn't have the same track record, but somebody that plays for the blue half of Manchester, somebody after this weekend, we have to wonder how much of an impact he can make on the rest of the Premier League race, because Manchester City has had a problem finding replacements for Kun Aguero during his injury spells this year. Wilfried Bony has been disappointment, and a young player from the academy, Kaliche Iheanacho, has had to step in. Well, Iheanacho had a hat trick this weekend at Villa Park, and Kartik, I can't help but think for City fans, this has to be a, I don't know if relief is the right word, but it has to be a cause for hope, because you actually have somebody that might be able to provide some production where production is really the only standard.
Yeah, it's been a long time since a youth player has been integrated fully into the Manchester City squad. He's the first one since maybe Micah Richards, Michael Johnson, that class of players.
Michael Johnson.
Michael Johnson, Stephen Ireland was part of that class. Iheanacho is a special player. I already, by my count, he's rescued 3 seasons for Manchester City. The game-winning goal against Crystal Palace, and then was instrumental in the comeback to equalize last week against West Ham.
True.
Let's not forget that.
Very true.
When he came on, that game changed, and Aguero got the equalizer. But without Iheanacho on the pitch, that equalizer doesn't happen. Actually, he had another game-winning goal against Swansea early season, so I guess that's 5. So he's already had an impact on the title race. In fairness, someone else might have gotten that particular if he hadn't been on. But the Palace one in the West Ham games, the results were shifted because he came on. He is giving Pellegrini some headaches now, in the sense that I think Pellegrini likes the guy's talent, wanted to bring him in very slowly this season, didn't buy another striker to replace both Jovetic and Dzeko were sold. He didn't buy a striker to replace either one of them because he thought Iheanacho could give spot minutes and it'd be good to give him a run out late in games several times this season in the Premier League. What instead has happened is he's become an integral core player, leaving Wilfried Bony, who's had some injury problems and has been inconsistent, off on the side, to the point where Manchester City supporters are like, why don't we just dump Bony? Why don't we get rid of him? There's been some talk of discontent with Bony. He put that down this week. But now it's caused a little bit of a headache where I think in Pellegrini's mind, he would still be more confident in sticking Wilfried Bony in late in matches to change the complexion of games when City is chasing a goal or chasing 3 points. But Iheanacho has played so well, and the media and the fans have talked about him so much that when Pellegrini doesn't put him on, he's getting savage. And that seems to be the takeaway. I run the SB Nation site for Manchester City, Bitter and Blue. That seems to be the takeaway after every match where Iheanacho doesn't play or comes on late. Well, Pellegrini doesn't have faith in this youngster. Why does he persist with Bony? Why does he even put Sterling or Navas on instead of him? Why isn't he playing all the time? So it's a bit of a dilemma.
I think one thing that needs to be considered by those fans and other people is the fit with Aguero, too. I don't think Bony and Aguero really fit well together. They don't seem to play off each other very much. I think a lot of that has to do with Bony, and stylistically, it doesn't seem like he's ever quite fit the tempo and the way that this Pellegrini team has been groomed to play. And I think Iheanacho fits that a little bit more. And I think Pellegrini has always liked the option of going with two strikers and then having those two interiores coming in from the wide positions. And given the personnel right now, even with De Bruyne going out for what looks like 2.5 months right now with ankle and knee injuries, you still have Silva and Sterling to play at that level. You can substitute Navas in when you think you have an advantage against the left fullback. You've got some depth in deep midfield now that Fabian Delph seems to have integrated and been a very positive addition to this team. I just like Iheanacho. Maybe he's not the better player, but he seems like the better complement to the team.
Yeah, I think he's the better player to play off of Aguero. That's a very good point. And the other thing you can do with Iheanacho is he can drop into midfield and play as kind of a hybrid striker off of Aguero if, let's say, Silva has to be subbed out now that De Bruyne is injured and Nasri continues to be injured. So that's something Bony doesn't give you. And in the way the Premier League season has evolved, Iheanacho was probably the better fit this season with the players he's playing around, too, with the Silvas, with the Swings, with the Navases. So I think the writing is a bit on the wall for Wilfred Bone, but the talk is Pellegrini won't be around next season. So maybe that's the reset button for Bone, or it's also possible he's gone in the summer.
Yeah, he seems like a really good signing for a Newcastle, a Sunderland, those teams that tend to pony up, you know, 14, 15 million transfer fees for these players that are coming back.
I wonder if Sunderland would do that again with Manchester City, because City has pawned both Adam Johnson and Jack Rodwell off on Sunderland for what are really exorbitant fees considering their level of production, low level of production.
That's very, very true. Plus, those were English players too, so maybe there was a slight markup on those players. Let's move on from Manchester City. Let's briefly talk about Arsenal. Alexis Sanchez came back this weekend, scored a meaningful goal as Arsenal had a little bit more difficulty with Burnley at the Emirates than I think most fans were anticipating. Sanchez got the winning goal in the 2-1 victory there. This is a big thing for the title race, Kartik. We're looking for these little points of differentiation between the top three teams, and if we can't find those points of differentiation, then we have to consider whether Spurs can continue to make up the gap. Getting Alexis Sanchez back, particularly as Mesut Ozil has slowed down a little bit over the last 3 or 4 weeks, could be a huge addition to this team.
Yeah, very well could be a huge addition. Danny Welbeck has also begun training again. That's another big deal that will also justify Wenger not going out and signing another striker, at least for now, until Welbeck gets injured again. But that's good news for Arsenal. Coughlin is back. Sanchez is back. Welbeck is about to be back. Wilshere nowhere near being back, although he might be offered a new contract.
Yeah, I think Wilshere has had another setback. It's going to be a couple of months still now. Tomas Rosicki is back, though, too. I don't know if that's going to be a big deal.
Oh,
but,
right. I forgot about that. But he's a guy that, I mean,
he's a versatile, capable player. It's just Arsenal has a lot of players, so it might depend on the health around Rosicki as to whether he's even making game day 18s. Let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about Liverpool. 0-0 result, playing mostly kids at home at Anfield against a West Ham team that pretty much threw out their first string squad. On the surface, it's a good result. You have mostly your academy guys. They don't get eliminated from the FA Cup against one of the better teams in the Premier League. Dig a little bit deeper. Liverpool, I believe at this point, is committed to raising their games played total to 58 this year. I'm sorry, I can't remember the exact numbers, either 58 or 59. They go a little bit farther in Europa League, go a little bit farther in the FA Cup. It's not hard to imagine that number stretching to 63, 65. It's just a lot of games for this squad to play.
Yeah, well, the kids were all right in this game, so to speak, because they held West Ham. They looked pretty good in the process, and West Ham has absolutely run Liverpool off the pitch twice this season in Premier League play. Those are two of the worst games. The single worst game under Klopp was the game at Upton Park. I think the game that probably got Rodgers to sack, even though he wasn't sacked after it, it was another month, was the game against West Ham where they got beat 3-0 at Anfield, even though West Ham was down to 10 men for 15 or 20 minutes at the end of that match. So this was a good result, and the kids looked pretty good in the process. But now we have another replay for Liverpool. I think you mentioned 58 or 59 games. Assuming they get past the next round in Europa League, that'll jump into the 60s. It's a problem for a squad that's not very deep. They were deep at the beginning of the season, but they've had so many injuries and so many nagging injuries, kind of minor injuries, 6 week, 8 week, nothing other than Danny Ings that's been season long, and Daniel Sturridge's inability to get back to fitness. It's something Klopp is having to contend with. But as we've talked about before, I don't know that their results matter a whole lot this season. I think there might be an emphasis on getting through these cup competitions. They're in the final of the League Cup. There's every belief that they could make a deep run in Europa. They're continuing to go in FA Cup, although now they're going to have to go to the Bowling Ground, which is very difficult. But on the surface, I guess this is a good thing. One other quick note about this. They play the league leaders Leicester on Tuesday, and they didn't play their first 11 in this match. So that's a good thing, because I was thinking 120 minutes on Tuesday in the League Cup semifinals plus penalties, 90 minutes against a good West Ham team at Anfield. You go to the King Power Stadium, and you might get run off the pitch by a Leicester team that's top of the table for a reason and is also well-rested.
Klopp made 10 changes to his starting lineup between the FA Cup semifinal against Stoke and then Saturday's match against West Ham. The only person in both lineups was Simone Mignolet, the goalkeeper. As long as he keeps doing that, then I think the number of games played statistic might end up sounding like a bit of an exaggeration. But if they go deeper in the FA Cup, there might be that temptation to start playing starters more. And if they're also still alive during Europa League at that time, it's going to become a little bit stressful. But as you said,
the league may not matter then. Maybe you play the kids in the league. Yeah. Honestly, it's sacrilegious as that sounds.
Yeah, it may depend on where they are in the league. If they slip down to eighth or ninth, maybe you go for some silverware and maybe you just use the summer to make that charge back into Europe next year. Leicester is one team that is benefiting from all this. We talked about the lack of teams bowing out over the first two rounds of this competition, that Premier League teams were in the FA Cup. Leicester is the only team competing for the title that has been eliminated. They also aren't involved in League Cup or Europa League. They only have their Premier League fixtures now. And as the other teams continue to rack up fixtures, maybe it won't matter, but it's not going to hurt Leicester to see them have to expend more resources. Let's talk about transfers before we go into the first break. We're entering the last days of the winter transfer window, which will close early this week. And a number of moves have been made since the last time we came to you midweek. A young prospect from Manchester City bought this summer. Enes Ünal goes out on loan to NAC in the Eredivisie. Mike Williamson's move to Wolverhampton Wanderers from Newcastle has been made permanent. Only £300,000 was the price set there. Sebastian Coates has left Sunderland on loan for Sporting Club in Portugal. His descent from huge prospect after Copa America a few years ago to now somebody that's bouncing around a little bit continues. And Patrick Bamford has found another home in the Premier League after returning to Chelsea from Crystal Palace after not getting enough playing time there. He's been loaned out to Manchester City.
Can I jump in on this one? This one's a little bit disappointing because we're hearing rumors that Leicester City, who were leading the league and could use more depth, might be in for Loic Remy. Now, if Chelsea were to sell Remy to Leicester, what's their master plan with strikers if Bamford's been loaned out again?
I think a lot of people, and we'll talk about this in a little bit when we talk about Matt Miazga, are now becoming more and more interested in what Chelsea's master plan for all of their prospects are. So let's talk about that in a second. Some other deals that maybe will have a bit more impact. This is one I took a bit of special interest in. A midfielder slash attacker from Bordeaux, Tunisian named Wabi Kankazi, moves from Bordeaux to Sunderland in what looks like a very Newcastle-esque move. You're getting a low-value attacker from Ligue 1, bringing him up north in England. And if it happened with Newcastle, you would say to yourself, boy, hasn't Newcastle made this move about 8 times in the last 2 years? The difference here is that Sunderland doesn't have any players of this type. Kazi is a very skilled, smart player, not particularly quick or not slow. He's not particularly explosive or anything like that. He's just a good, solid player that you wouldn't mind having the ball, needing to make a play. It's the type of player that Sunderland has been lacking, and I think this is a really, really good addition for them, Kartik.
Yeah, I agree. Big Stamp has been really searching deep in continental football to find some guys to bring in. It's funny, Newcastle, which had been the very kind of foreign team in that part of the country, has now doubled down on English players in this window, going out and getting Jonjo Shelvey, Andros Townsend, and now really going hard after Saidi Berahino, so all English players. Sunderland has been very aggressive under Big Sam. This is similar to what he did at Bolton. At Bolton, he signed a lot of foreign players at a time when there weren't as many foreign. There were a lot, but not quite like today. And he's gone hard into continental football during this window, has in fact, between Sunderland matches, been scouting himself, going to the continent, watching players, talking to scouts, trying to get the deals done himself. I think he's counting on getting guys like Kazi in to save the team from relegation. He's made the determination that the players he inherited are not good enough. Mm-hmm. And all indications, all the data points we have, they're not. So he's pretty radically changing this team in the January window, which is risky, but they're going to go down if they don't do it. So I think he really had little choice.
Yeah, it wasn't an expensive buy either. I believe the total on this was something like £5 million. So in relative terms, in terms of the Premier League, what they normally expend, it wasn't that expensive. A couple of teams looking to shore up their striking options. Swansea looking for those goals that'll keep them out of the championship have brought in Alberto Paloschi from Chievo. And then Everton beating a couple of more prominent clubs to the signing of Lokomotiv Moscow's Senegalese striker, striker Umar Niasi, 24, 25 years old there in the Russian Premier League. He's been good for a goal, about a goal in every two games, a decent striker there. But Kartik, somebody that Premier League fans are going to know a little bit more, is returning to the Premier League after his time at QPR. Former Tottenham midfielder Sandro is going to be on loan with Tony Pulis and West Brom through the end of the season.
I mean, Pulis is just doubling down on his type of players. And when you said Sandro was returning to the Premier League, I was wondering if you were actually even going to give us the club, because it was so predictable. Pulis, I guess, has decided this season. We saw some changes from him toward the end of his Stoke tenure. The efforts of trying to go with more quick, wide players, Etherington Kane, Jermaine Pennant. At Crystal Palace, he inherited a much more cosmopolitan squad and had to play to that squad's strengths. And guys like Punchin and Velocity had good second halves of that season when Pulis went to Palace. Now at West Brom, we've seen him just double down on his type of player, his style of play, and gutting out results. So, yeah, if you want a holding midfielder, Sandro's a pretty good one by Premier League standards, especially by Championship standards. And QPR will be happy to get him off their books for the six-month period. But my goodness, Pulis is not making any progressive changes to his squad, is he?
No, he's playing to type right now. It's as if he's recognized his brand. He's not going to run from it anymore. I guess that's admirable in one sense, but eventually there are going to be enough teams in the Premier League that are going to be able to ruin the best line on his resume, the idea that he's never gotten a team relegated. They're certainly playing. They're playing in a way to where if enough teams below them figure out their kind of magic formulas, I don't know what the ceiling is on this West Brom team. Like, if three or four teams below the Baggies right now in the Premier League actually go on runs that we see teams go on at the end of seasons, they're going to be in trouble, because the way that Tony Pulis has constructed this squad, they might be at their ceiling right now. As bad as they are, as boring as they are, the best case scenario for them is Solomon Rondon finds some goals. And I don't know the way they're playing that he really does that many opportunities being created behind him. Kartik, you and Nipun talked about Alexandre Pato signing for Chelsea midweek. That has actually gone through. It's official. He's going to be on loan for Corinthians for the rest of the season. But Chelsea was also in the other major news of the week, transfer news of the week. At least it's major news over here. New York Red Bull central defender, 20-year-old Matt Miazga, somebody who has broken into the senior national team for the United States, left the U.S.'s camp in Southern California this week, flew to England, signed on a £3.5 million move. He's going to be moving to the Premier League in Chelsea. This is one of the more prominent moves in U.S. national team history. Chelsea is one of the seven, eight most prestigious clubs in the world. And while we've seen the Manchester Uniteds or the Borussia Dortmunds come over here and pluck young players and bring them over into their academy, we rarely see a senior level player make this kind of move, Kartik. And while this isn't a blockbuster multi-million, I guess technically it is multi-million, but it's not an eight-digit deal. This is somebody prospecting on a young player. This is still a very significant move for the U.S., for the MLS's academy system, and for Miazga himself.
It's highly significant. This is a player, he's a New Jersey native. He came through Red Bull's academy. MLS's academy structure is new. MLS teams have set up their academies in the last 5 to 7 years. Actually, Red Bull, along with Dallas, one of the other where the teams had originally set up academies. Dallas actually has a former academy player who spent 9 months with them, then went back to Argentina, Funes Mori, who's been playing quite well for Everton. So that's another former MLS academy player. They're now two in the Premier League. Although Funes Mori, as I said, only spent 9 months in Dallas Academy and really became a good player when he moved back to Argentina. Mm-hmm. Miazga is the first guy to really come through an academy, become an MLS designated homegrown player, not designated player. I'm sorry. With MLS, there are all these terms. So you can't even use your normal vocabulary. The status homegrown player, and then moved on to a big club in the Premier League. I can also tell you, based on what some of the reporting I've done and reports I've seen elsewhere, both Manchester City and Leicester City, the top two clubs in the Premier League right now, were interested in Miazga, but they were looking at him over the summer.
Wow.
So Chelsea came in before those two clubs did. Although, given Leicester's lack of depth on the back line, let's say an injury to Wes Morgan or Robert Huth took place, maybe they could have used him this season. But he's not displacing either two guys now. So maybe Leicester was thinking, summer, we're going to be in Europe next season. We need to start building up for for that eventuality. So he goes to Chelsea. This is a great deal for the United States. The way I would describe Miazga, and you've watched as much of him as I have, Richard, and you've seen him in person as well. I've seen him in person a few times now. He's a good ball-playing defender, which is something Chelsea has not had since David Luiz, or central defender since David Luiz moved to PSG. A guy who's comfortable with the ball at his feet. His clearances tend to be pretty good. Now, where I think it's a bit of a problem in the Premier League is I don't see him as a strong, physical, ball-winning central defender. And that concerns me about a move to any Premier League club, especially Chelsea, which has had the likes of John Terry, who have been as good at that as anyone in the history of this league.
Mm-hmm. For somebody that's as big as he is, he's 6'4". What Premier League fans are going, what's going to stand out to Premier League fans is he doesn't look particularly strong. He's not somebody that's going to win those aerial battles. Like, people will automatically assume anybody that big will. I mean, he's not gonna shy away from them. He's not gonna be terrible, but he's not gonna be the dominant presence that people expect. And then his actual defending, he defends like an inexperienced 20-year-old sometimes, and that's just part of the process, and that's part of why he only costs £3.5 million. But I guess it's kind of a lazy comparison, Kartik, but it is one that will at least give people some idea of what Chelsea is getting. Is there are a lot of John Stones parallels here, as far as the skill he has on the ball, as far as his athleticism, as far as just the raw state of his game, and as far as the potential is concerned. I don't think that he has the high end that John Stones does. I mean, Stones possibly moves this summer for £50 million. I don't think Matt Miazga will ever command that price. But when you're talking about the style of player, I don't think it's unfair to think that he's of that mold.
Yeah, and I would actually mention, you mentioned Stones. That's absolutely right. And he's a lot like Luiz. Luiz wasn't a good one-on-one defender, but he's of that mold. Now, Chelsea, I think, in their evolution, under managers like Andre Villas-Boas and Carlo Ancelotti, tried to get that style player and wanted that kind of player pairing with John Terry. What has ended up happening since is that we've seen a situation where Jose Mourinho came back to the club and doubled down. And to him, the partnership of Cahill, a guy like Cahill and Terry was essential. And then you wanted to get a guy like Kurt Zouma, who's quick, who's faster, but who's equally strong and not very good on the ball, into that team. So I think it may speak to Chelsea's desire to change stylistically. Does that give us a hint as to who the next manager will be at Chelsea? Could it be Sparky, Mark Hughes? That's been rumored this week. I don't think it will be, but stylistically, this is the kind of player that Hughes would sign and the kind of player that Tony Pulis or Jose Mourinho would not.
And of course, Kartik, there is an obvious connection, obvious to us, but certainly not obvious to the rest of the world, a connection between Miazga and Sparky, as weird as that sounds.
Yes, so his agent is Ryan Nelson, who played for Sparky both at QPR and at QPR and Blackburn. And Nelson works with Kia Jarabshin, who is also Mark Hughes' advisor. And that's probably how Ryan Nelson got to know Kia Jarabshin, was through Sparky. So that is another connection to Sparky. And who knows? That with all those connections, maybe Sparky is in fact talking to Chelsea, or is at least on Chelsea's radar. You would think Simeone is the leading candidate for that, but Simeone might be looking at the Chelsea situation saying, maybe I'll wait for Manchester United or for another job to come open.
After this weekend, though, maybe Diego Simeone will be trying to get out of Spain quickly, ending his match against Barcelona with 9 men. We're going to talk about that match after the break. We're going to talk about what's going on in Germany. But for most of you, the most important part of the next segment will be us breaking down the midweek action of the Premier League, the 24th round of the season, the marquee matchup there being Liverpool's visit to Leicester. Stay with us. This is the World Soccer Talk podcast. Welcome back to the show. There was no action in the Premier League this weekend, but in Spain, arguably the most important game in the table for the rest of the season took place. It's not the most important game culturally. There's another Clásico to go in Spain this year, but Atletico Madrid and Barcelona met for the second time this season, Barcelona having already won at the Vicente Calderón earlier this year. And on Saturday, Atletico Madrid gave notice early that they were going to take those 3 points back. Gabi with an early goal, giving Atleti a 1-0 lead. at Barcelona's home ground. Unfortunately, as the first half went on, Kartik, this game tilted drastically towards Barcelona. A great defensive effort for Atletico, their customary great defensive effort, was broken apart by a Barcelona team that really looked unstoppable, particularly on their first goal. Second goal, maybe one of the weaker goals Atletico has let in all year. But by the time this game reached halftime 2-1, Atletico had also lost a man after Felipe Luis went studs up into Lionel Messi's knee. Second half, they lose Diego Godin. Ends up finishing 2-1. Barcelona is 3 points clear at the top of Spain.
Yeah, and they've still got that match in hand. So this is a tough one, I think, for who wants to see a competitive race in the league. The two sending offs did Atleti in. They have a situation, and I hate to get into this argument. I don't want to get into a philosophical argument with Barca fans and with people who enjoy beautiful football, but I caught some flack yesterday for saying, what else is Atleti supposed to do? And Diego Simeone, now I know that they've in some ways become characters of themselves. They have guys sent off in these games, typically, and we even saw in the second leg last year against Real Madrid after they had held so well against them in both the league and the Champions League up to that point, at some point the dam breaks. We saw it in the Champions League final, but I'm not quite sure what else Atleti is supposed to do when they play Barcelona or Real Madrid. And I know philosophically people say, well, just play football and try, and so you're supposed to unilaterally disarm. What? Well, you're done telling me.
But it's also the old debate. Why isn't what Simeone doing football? Because when I looked at what they did yesterday, now Simeone has been trying to play two strikers a lot this year, sometimes three strikers, to accommodate the purchases they made this offseason. He went to one striker in this game. He started Griezmann up top, Ferreira Carrasco behind him, and it was obviously a more defensive approach. But when you see the way that he sets up his team, when you see the passing angles that he wants his team to cut down on, Carrasco a lot of the time was spending his time cutting off Busquets from the flanks, which is a big part for Barcelona's team. It might have actually cost them on the second goal because Dani Alves playing more direct to Luis Suarez without having Busquets as an outlet back into the middle. And you see the intensity that Atleti play with, which is unmatched by any team in the world. It's like they're constantly doing the pressing that Klopp's teams do in bursts. I don't know what's not beautiful about that. It's as if we just don't have an aesthetic, Kartik, where we can ever appreciate defending on any level. Because if we could, we would appreciate what Atletico is doing.
Right, I think we would appreciate it. And I think part of it is Barcelona has a very good control of, I don't want to say control, but they have a lot of sympathy in the press for various reasons, both football-wise and politically. Mm-hmm. So because of that, play this way against Barcelona, and you repeatedly play this way against Barca, because Atleti has been playing this way against Barca now for several seasons. Going back to when Kiki Sanchez Flores was their manager, so it's been 5-6 seasons of this, there's just this narrative that's developed that, well, they're just negative, they're brutalizing their opposition. And this whole narrative about Atleti, people who don't watch Atleti regularly are giving me this narrative about how they're this awful thing for football. And I don't have any time for that.
I don't either, because they don't play, or at least you don't see the same fouls in every Atletico game. You have to give Barcelona some credit. Barcelona's skill, Barcelona's speed, Barcelona's talent brought a lot of that out of Atletico. You saw some of the fouls that Juan Fran made in this game. He wasn't going in dirty. He was cleaning some people out because he was playing hard. And Barcelona was just that elusive. Maybe there is a mentality difference. Maybe they do try to send a message. But to paint Atletico with this big, broad brush based on the one Atletico game that people are more likely to see than other ones, I think it's foolish. I like watching Atletico play probably more than 99% of teams in the world. I can watch them every game.
I watch them more than any other in Spain. I'll admit that their games are the ones I watch, and I don't really watch. I shouldn't be saying this on this podcast. I don't really watch Barcelona or Real Madrid in their domestic league very much, honestly. But I watch anytime Atleti's on and I'm around, I watch them. So I watch much more of them than those other two teams in the domestic league, at least.
Spain's table right now has Barcelona clear at the top, 3 points clear of Atletico Madrid, still with a game in hand after their win this weekend at the Camp Nou. Atletico in second place with 48. Real Madrid, 1 point back on 47 after their drubbing of Espanyol this weekend. And then Villarreal still staying within distance of Real Madrid, fourth place, 44 points. Let's go to the Bundesliga, Kartik. I know you watched the Borussia Dortmund match this weekend, 2-0 victory, two late goals by Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. This match is going to be remembered on this side of the pond for another reason, though.
Yeah, the American Wonder Kid. I think the kid, and we fall in love with young American players, and we're probably worse. We're looking for that next great thing, and we haven't ever had that world-class player. But Christian Pulisic, young man from Pennsylvania, he's only 17. He turned 17 in September. He made the decision to try his luck, go to Borussia Dortmund on trial last year, did very well, made their U17 squad, was a key player for the United States. In a number of youth internationals, and now has injuries. And we saw Ramos start yesterday for Borussia Dortmund. Due to injuries, has made the bench for Borussia Dortmund the last two matches, and has come into the match. It was inserted in the 68th minute with the score 0-0 against Ingolstadt on Saturday. Now think about this: we can't even get American veteran players who are regulars on the senior national team game time at places like Sunderland and places like Aston Villa or clubs like Eintracht Frankfurt in Timothy Chandler's case. And we've got a few guys. John Brooks is playing at Hertha Berlin at a very high level. Fabian Johnson's been great for Mönchengladbach. I think Jeff Cameron has played pretty well for Stoke, although he's been moved around the pitch. That's about it. And we've now got a kid playing at 17, getting game time with a game on the line at one of the 10 best in the world right now. Club
Yeah.
team. It's just amazing.
When he entered
when
the
you think
game, it
about
was
it.
0-0. Like you said, game was on the line. They didn't just insert him because they could. They entered him because they felt he would help deliver him 3 points. I think that's great. Something that we talked about on Twitter a little bit that I do want to talk about here. Over the last 2 weeks, we've talked about three, or the world really, the soccer world has talked about three main U.S. prospects here. Jordan Morris, covered that a lot on the site. Miazga, which we have also covered a lot on the site, and then Pulisic, which we've not covered at all on this podcast or the site. And that's kind of the order that people have given their attention to these prospects. Jordan Morris, big 48-point font at the top of the page. Miazga getting the column, the sidebar. And then Pulisic, you have to flip to the back page. That's ass backwards. It should be the other way. Pulisic is doing something that no
Right.
American prospect has ever done. Miazga is a year younger and has a year and a half pro experience on Jordan Morris. Jordan Morris's big thing is that he got into the senior national team as a college player, and he deserves attention for that. But if Jordan Morris wasn't linked with the MLS team that has the biggest fan base in the country, and if he didn't become this kind of, I don't even know what to call it. He's this hat that MLS fans have come to hang on. He's this litmus test for the league for no justifiable reason. It doesn't have anything to do with him as a player, so to speak. It's these cultural things. And what we really should be doing as a culture is looking at the Pulisic's more than the Morris's.
He is 4 years older than Pulisic. Pulisic has now made his professional debut in a very, very big game for the team that's second in the Bundesliga that is going to qualify for the UEFA Champions League at the age of 17. Jordan Morris still hasn't played a professional club football match. He still hasn't played an actual official game. He will on March 6th when MLS kicks off, or we presume he will. It's confounding to me. He's a player that fits a need, a position that the U.S. Is weak at, which is the striker position. The U.S. has more midfield options, not necessarily good midfield options, but more midfield options. Certainly has more defensive options, which is why it took Miazga. And also, I have to say, with Miazga, the United States puts an emphasis on doing well in youth. So Miazga was kept on the U20 squad and the U23 squad at critical times for the senior national team because the thought was it's better for Miazga to anchor the defense at the U20 World Cup, which he did, and he did quite well. And I think that's where he caught Chelsea's eye, was at that U20 World Cup, as well as playing United States Olympic qualifying team in an Olympic qualifying when he could have been playing for the senior national team. So, but because of the senior national team call-ups, we've given Morris increased importance. And you mentioned the Seattle factor. I don't want to get too deep into this, but Seattle has the largest fan base in Major League Soccer. They have the most vocal fan base in Major League Soccer. They also have perhaps the biggest media footprint outside of Los Angeles in the American soccer media landscape. Now, there are a lot of people like you and I that cover European football that are in various points in parts of the country. But if you want to look at people who actually cover U.S. soccer closely, Seattle and Los Angeles, the two kind of, and maybe New York also, but New York, it's more dispersed. And there's a sense that, at least from where I sit, that that narrative was developed a lot by Seattle journalists and Seattle-based writers who cover Major League Soccer. And so it's this great litmus test. They've signed Jordan Morris. We'll see if the kid develops. He's 21. He's already behind the development curve. If you look at it that way, and he's going to be stuck in Major League Soccer until he's at least 23 or 24. And then you've got Miazga over to Chelsea at 20. You've got Pulisic over to Borussia Dortmund at 16, makes his full debut at 17.
And you have Cameron Carter-Vickers at 18 that seems to be on the cusp of the Spurs senior team too. So
yeah, in Cameron Carter-Vickers' case, I think there's some issues development-wise. I watched him in a U21 game against Chelsea, and he still makes some mistakes, but you can see the raw talent.
Yeah.
And he's getting games at that level. And he's a guy that they're very high on. So that's another guy who's following another path. So we celebrate the path of guys who sign in Major League Soccer, but we should be celebrating these other paths, including Miazga, who used Major League Soccer to his benefit with the academy system and then playing a year and a half as a full first teamer with the New York Red Bulls. And I think that is a much better story for Major League Soccer and growing the footprint and the relevance of Major League Soccer in this global game than Jordan Morris, in my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And I think Jordan Morris has given every indication to believe that he is going to be, or at least has the talent to be a major contributor. I think this, like you said, just speaks to the power of the Seattle fans. They're hungry for coverage of the things that they like. And I don't think that's a negative, but I think for other people looking in on this, the hype around Jordan Morris doesn't mean that he's a better prospect than these other people we're talking about. In fact, of the four people that we mentioned, I'd probably put him number four or very close to number three with Miazga.
But unfortunately, when I've talked to casual fans of U.S. soccer who don't follow MLS, and I mentioned Miazga and I mentioned Jordan Morris, they all knew who Jordan Morris was and they didn't know who Miazga was. I mean, these are people who watch American sports and then they watch the Premier League. And they're like, who's this guy going to Chelsea? And these are the same people who were unhappy 2 weeks ago that Jordan Morris, who they had been following, signed in MLS instead of signing with Werder Bremen. And for those people now, they're not going to follow Morris as closely as they would have if he had been at Bremen. But I know several people who are like that, who just follow the Premier League and the Bundesliga or whatever, and then watch the NFL and the NBA. They don't watch Major League Soccer. Mm-hmm. So Miazga kind of caught them by surprise that the player good enough in Major League Soccer that is American, that could attract the interest from Chelsea. And as I mentioned earlier, it's attracting interest of Manchester City and Leicester City also, but they were looking to buy him in the summer. His MLS contract, by the way, was expiring next year.
Mm. You know, after spending a year living in down where you do, Kartik, I am never going to underestimate certain regions of the country, their ability to just not care about Major League Soccer. Maybe that'll change when Beckham lands there, but people should realize there are some deeply soccer-loving parts of this country. South Florida, San Diego, two places I've lived in, to be specific, that love soccer as much as any place in this country that just do not care about Major League Soccer at all. All right, Kartik, let's look towards midweek. Let's talk about round 24. Let's count down from 10 to 1. The matches of this week, from the matches we think you should be most interested in to the matches we think everybody are going to be most interested, least interested to most interested. Starting at number 10, West Brom versus Swansea City. These are two teams that have struggled for goals this season. Both teams now have some attacking talent, Swansea having brought in Pelosi midweek. Swansea has actually been on a bit of an uptick too, obviously having made some changes to their coaching staff over the last 2 weeks. Still, this is a West Brom game, Kartik. I can't recommend people watch this one.
No, I'm not interested in this game, and I'm hoping Swansea take the 3 points and put West Brom further in the relegation battle.
Number 9, Crystal Palace and Bournemouth.
Yeah, this is a little bit more interesting. Bournemouth has been gutting out some results, and they've been on a bit of an uptick, and they're obviously now into the fifth round of the FA Cup. Derby with Port Pompey. Ironically enough, five seasons ago, Pompey was a top-flight team. Bournemouth was a fourth division team. This FA Cup, two kind of localized rivals, reversed situation.
Similar financial histories.
Yeah, similar financial histories. Thank you. Palace, they've now won two in the FA Cup back-to-back against Premier League opposition, but their performance actually in league games has been getting worse and worse and worse. So this is an opportunity maybe for Bournemouth to get some points at Selhurst Park. And keep in mind that their uptick, Bournemouth, began with a draw against Palace at home last month. One other note, Emmanuel Adebayor has signed on a free for Palace. I don't think we've mentioned that.
Yeah, and that's going to be a big thing. Palace has not scored a goal on their own volition for the last six Premier League matches. They need somebody to step in there.
Worthwhile gamble for Pardew, right?
Absolutely. It's a free. Oh, probably a worthwhile gamble for most of the league. He just happens to be going to Crystal Palace. Number eight, Everton versus Newcastle. A lot of skill on display in this game. Two very talented teams, Kartik, but two teams that are probably underperforming their talent levels.
Yeah, both are underperforming, and we might say draw here. I think the noose is really tightening on Roberto Martinez, so he needs results soon. Newcastle has made two moves for Townsend and Shelvey. They are looking to get Berahino in before the window. We'll know, obviously, by the time this match kicks off, they do. West Brom, again, being stubborn. Newcastle has offered in cash money up front. 23 or 24 million, I saw, rejected by West Brom. So I don't know what West Brom's doing. They're holding the kid hostage. We talked about this before. But if Newcastle doesn't get Berahino, I think they've got some concerns. I mean, I assumed in this window they would get a striker, and that would be the right guy that's on the market. But maybe they have to look elsewhere in the next day to get someone.
Yeah, it'd be a really good fit there, and it's turning somewhat sad to see what's going on with Seydou Berahino there. A mess of his own making a little bit, but it seems like pure stubbornness on West Brom's part. Number seven on our list, West Ham versus Aston Villa. West Ham consistently giving us good performances, and lately Aston Villa showing signs of life too. This is a big ask for Remy Gard's revolution there.
Yeah, I think we're... Again, as Ahmed Youssef meant to us last week, I think Aston Villa now is playing for Remy Gard's shop window job. They played better. They were on a five-game unbeaten until yesterday's loss in all cup to Manchester City. I think they'll play well here, but West Ham will have a little too much for them.
Number six match on this list, another good one. This is going to be a highly competitive one. Watford versus Chelsea. Chelsea, we saw their offense come to life this weekend. Eden Hazard scoring his first goal for the Blues in 9 months. Watford got back into the win column last week. You would have to make them the slight favorites in this one.
Yeah, Watford really should have beaten Chelsea in Goose Heating's first match last month. And this is a bit of a local derby. Watford now considers themselves a London club. I believe they might even be on the same underground line as closest to Stamford Bridge. So they are this is a bit of a local derby, and I think Watford, just based on the surface of what we see, they should win this match. But it seems like Chelsea, there are some positive signs, and so I'll say draw here.
Yeah, they're at least solidifying. Draw feels right in this one, with Watford waning a little bit, just getting back into the win column after three straight, or I believe it was three straight losses. It might have been four straight losses. But either way, they're just starting to get back on track. Number five on this list is pretty much here because there's a title contender in this game. Sunderland has looked better at times under Sam Allardyce, but they're still in the bottom three. Manchester City will be hoping to get full points in this one. Easier said than done.
Yeah, and in both of Manchester City's title-winning seasons, they have dropped points against Sunderland. Both of Manchester City's title-winning seasons, Sunderland have been the only team to take 4 points off of Manchester City in the league both times. Actually, the second time Manchester City won the title, Chelsea took all 6 points, but Sunderland took 4 points, only team in 11-12 most points, and then only team besides Chelsea to get two results against Manchester City the next time. Now, City, given that history, might want to drop this game, but I think this is a very different Premier League season, right? So we're looking at a situation where I think we're going to probably see Manchester City win this, as Sunderland is integrating all these new parts at the end of the January window. Another note, Manchester City had lost four in a row, four straight league games at Sunderland prior to last season. Again, another indication that this has been a bogey team for Manchester City. And as I said, the only team to take points off of Manchester City at Eastlands in both of their title winning seasons.
Norwich versus Tottenham. Tottenham going to a Norwich team that has struggled but has made a couple of big purchases of late. Slowly they're getting pulled back into the relegation battle. Tottenham going in the other direction, arguably the form side in the Premier League. And in that way, this is a good test for their title ambitions. They have some points to make up on Leicester. They need to get 3 points out of these games lest they continue their drawing ways and continue to fall back. Whereas Norwich, they need to take advantage of these home games to start pulling themselves away from that drop.
Yeah, this feels like the kind of game Spurs would lose if they're going to fall out of the title race, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does feel like a litmus test of sorts.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's the term I was going to use. This is a litmus test game. So I think we'll have a lot to talk about based on the result of this match for Spurs. And then, of course, for Norwich, I think Norwich has played well enough to not be pulling away from this drop zone, but they haven't. And now they've made some interesting signings, maybe most interesting, Stephen Naismith coming over from Everton. So they need to start winning some of these games, getting points.
Top three games we're going to slow down a little bit, spend some more time talking about. The first was one that I couldn't wrap my head around putting them in these top three, but it is Manchester United, and they are hosting a Stoke team people are very excited about. But given the dour nature of these teams' attacks, Kartik, one, I can't get excited about this game, and two, I just see this ending in a 0-0 unless some kind of set piece or penalty freakery happens.
Yeah, and Stoke has had a good record the last few weeks against Manchester United. I see this being a 0-0 or a 1-1, honestly. And I think United has this little bit of a feel-good factor in the sense that they got past Derby. A lot of people didn't see that as an expected result. They hadn't been paying too close attention to the championship the last few weeks where Derby has tailed off.
That's true. I thought Derby was still good.
Yeah, and in reality, Derby in a massive funk, so it was the right time to play them. But it's credit to them. Still went to Pride Park, got the result, no replay. The thinking was that they would probably need a replay at best to get through that round. So there's a bit of a feel-good factor, but most recent Premier League result was that loss at Old Trafford to Southampton. I just think that they're in a position where they will probably draw this match, and it'll be a dour draw. On Stoke's side, we know how it works with this so-called new wave Stoke Alona of Sparky, where they do look like Barcelona one match, and then they're terrible. Mm-hmm. And they were terrible against Leicester. They lost 3-0. They could have lost 6-7, 8-0. It was that one-sided. And so I think they'll probably play well in this game. So I'm going to tip it for a draw.
I'm going to apologize to everybody because I want to talk about Stoke a little bit more. And the reason I keep harping on Stoke is probably my experience as an editor running sites. And I know how easy it is to not actually pay attention to the games and fall in love with a narrative, particularly if it's a romantic one, about a team that was so bad as far as their playing style is concerned, and now they look so great. And there are definitely times where if Stoke doesn't look great, it looks like they're at least trying to play great. And I definitely think you have to give them credit for that. But there are some things we have to keep in mind. After this weekend's game, there are over 560 minutes against top-flight opposition where they haven't scored a goal, unless you count the goal against Liverpool where Zukić was offside. That's a huge amount of time. They've only scored 24 goals in 23 Premier League games, and if you take out the goals where they've had a man advantage, they're scoring less than a goal per 90 minutes, 11 on 11. They're 16th in the league in shots per game, and they're holding less than 50% of the ball. There's no basis for this Stoke narrative, this beautiful Stoke narrative. There is basis for thinking they want to play that way, though. And I think part of the reason I keep coming back to it, Kartik, is it strikes me as very, very lazy. And if I say this as somebody that if I were an editor, I would think myself lazy for accepting a pitch or having one of my writers write about this. If 2 weeks later I then looked at these numbers, I would just be embarrassed by it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that that's a really good point, because my sense is that Stoke wants to play a certain way, but at times they still have to revert to.
Yeah.
And they have such a mishmash of players. They have players inherited from Pulis, and then they have guys that designed to try and evolve the style that don't necessarily correspond with the way you have to play at times in the Premier League. It doesn't look good at times. And so now we have this inconsistency. And as I said earlier, you have one game where they're really on and then one game where they're really off. So I think this will be a game where they're on and they probably get a goal, maybe get two goals, and they get a draw at worst.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that tendency to revert happens the second they hit the final third. They just haven't developed enough of an identity to really put together those movements or to read each other well enough to break down a defense once they have that defensive shape set up in front of their goal. And hopefully that'll come in time. And hopefully Stoke City sticks with this. Of course, if they lose Mark Hughes this summer, maybe they'll have another change of course. Let's talk about the next game on our list, the second one, Arsenal versus Southampton. We've talked about Arsenal so much on this show. Listeners don't need any context for the third place team in the league right now. Southampton, on the other hand, three wins in a row. They're up to eighth in the league. Their plus eight goal difference is actually tied for fifth best in the league. They've only allowed 24 goals in 23 games. Kartik, it seems like they've weathered the storm. And if they have weathered the storm, if they're closer to the team that we saw through most of last year, this is going to be a very difficult match for Arsenal.
Yeah, it's going to be a very difficult match. The question is, has Southampton actually turned the corner, or have they just found a little bit of
I don't know. Form? Yeah, what do you think?
I'm not sure either. I think we'll know after this game. If they have turned the corner, they're going to get a result, whether it's a draw, whether it's a 1-1 draw, 0-0 draw, or maybe they're going to win 1-0. because defensively they seem to have come back together. But there were times this season where they looked so poor defensively, and their movement wasn't good enough. Now they've also got Charlie Austin potentially as a striker playing against with Mertesacker suspended against Gabriel and Koscielny as the center backs. I like that matchup for Southampton. So Sadio Mane has been playing very well. You see now why Southampton, even though they've sold all these other players, why they refuse to sell him. Wanyama, as of this point, has not been sold yet. Maybe he gets sold to Arsenal tomorrow and he just doesn't play in this game. But if he doesn't get sold, that's another guy that's beginning to play a little better. And I think you're looking at a real possibility for Southampton to take points. And there's nothing in Arsenal's performances recently, including the Burnley game in the FA Cup, that makes me think Arsenal is putting this bad spell behind them. Now, obviously, we talk about Sanchez getting back and that Welbeck is close to a return. Coughlin is back. But again, those doubts about Arsenal are beginning to creep in. So I think they're probably going to struggle in this game.
For everything that has gone right for Arsenal in terms of the lack of quality at the top of the Premier League this year, it is extremely telling to me that they're in third place right now. So much has happened in Arsenal's favor. United hasn't rebounded. Chelsea is a disaster. Manchester City is performing below expectations. Even Leicester, that has been the best team in the league thus far, hasn't found the consistency to take advantage of all those situations, and Spurs are still in their growth phase. If you had said all that at the beginning of the year, you'd say, this is Arsenal's year. They're going to do it. The pavement is clear for them to win a title. They're in third place. Now, I'm still putting them number one on my list as far as end of the season, the team that I think is going to win this title. But the idea that they've shaken their ghosts of the past are refuted by where they come into this weekend at. They're 3 points behind the leaders. I keep going back to the idea that we said on other shows, Kartik, that Vincent Kompany is the most important player in the Premier League. The difference between City's defense when he's there and not is enough to decide the title. And maybe that's the case, but Mesut Ozil, if he's not the most important player in the Premier League, he's probably the second, because when he is performing at his best, when he's performing as a player that looks like a future Ballon d'Or contender, then Arsenal is the best team in this league. And when they're not, they just don't have anybody else that's able to step up.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, that's what we've seen when Ozil has been injured or has dipped in form. And he was playing out of his mind for several months this season and has had a little bit of a dip recently. We have all these concerns about Arsenal, and they don't have that creative spark. They don't have that kind of probing passing ability coming from other points on midfield. Now, maybe the guy to provide some cover there is Tomas Rosicki, who you mentioned earlier. But Rosicki now is, he's been on Arsenal 10 seasons. This is 10th season with the team.
That's kind of cool to think about.
That is kind of cool. And obviously, for Dortmund before that. So he's been at big clubs this whole time. But I'm not quite sure he's he is quite the player that can give you that can spell you for long enough in that situation to where he can offset any drop in form from Ozil. And what we're finding is that there's not a whole lot else to say about that in terms of Arsenal, that they, in spite of all their depth and all the quality players they have, and Alexis Sanchez being out of the lineup that time, during that period of time, it seems they go as Mesut Ozil goes, which might explain why they fell away in the title race 2 seasons ago and were never in that race last season. Now they're very much squarely in the title race, and he's found a little bit of a dip, and no fault of his own, because I think he was just playing at a out-of-the-world level, and they've had a dip as well because of it.
Arsenal is now 5th in the league of goals scored. I don't think many people realize that. I didn't realize that until researching for today's show. And they're 4th in goal difference. Those aren't really numbers that you associate with a team that not only has its stylistic preferences, but the goal difference, too, is something that three other teams have passed them at this point.
Right, and Spurs having a better goal difference than Arsenal hasn't happened, as far as I remember. Because even when Spurs were close to Arsenal in terms of points in previous years, and they were fighting for fourth, or they were fighting for whatever position, fighting for third one, and Chelsea in the Champions League that year, Arsenal consistently was getting better score lines than they were. So this is that's a very interesting development. Spurs are actually +6 points on Arsenal, I believe. +6 or +7.
Yeah, +7. They're tied with Manchester City for the best goal difference in the league, and of course Spurs have the best defense of the league. And Kartik, one of the teams that does have the better goal difference than Arsenal right now, Leicester City, league leading by 3 points on Manchester City and Arsenal. They're hosting Liverpool this weekend. One thing that I heard you and Nipun talk about, and I talked about with Nipun in another place, was the viability of Leicester City as a title contender. And one thing that we mentioned off the air a couple of weeks ago when we were doing our show, I think bears repeating here, we ask ourselves, is Leicester a legitimate title contender? Can they keep this up? We're 23 weeks into this season. We only have 15 games left, and they're 3 points clear. They're title contenders, period. No matter whether you think they're a good team or not, anybody in that situation is a title contender.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we can even have this discussion anymore. It's comical that we're having this discussion. They're in a position where they have proven through every single predicted swoon that was coming that they could survive. And they have had their wobbles. They have had their swoons already. And they've come out on the other end, still in the top four. And now they're back at top of the table. So with Arsenal's recent poor performance, I don't think we can have this conversation again. And quite honestly, the next three matches are their three most difficult matches for the rest of the season. And if they come through that and they're still there or thereabouts, mm-hmm. you have to talk about them. Even if they fall behind Arsenal and Manchester City in the next 10 days, in the next 2 weeks, you're going to have to still talk about them because they have an easier run-in.
So maybe we can make that the context for this discussion, because this Liverpool match doesn't seem to be existing in isolation. Leicester then has to go to Manchester City and they have to go to Arsenal. They dropped points at home to both of those teams earlier this year, although in drastically different ways. Arsenal went to King Power, won 5-2, really gave people some ammunition to think that Leicester was not going to stick around. Whereas Manchester City went to the King Power Stadium last month, played with only one striker, seemed content to get a 0-0 draw, and got that 0-0 draw. So with that in mind, you look over these three games, the Liverpool game, not only because it's at home, but because it's against Liverpool, looks like the most winnable. But in that sense, it's also the riskiest, because if they get this three-match stretch off onto a bad note, it really could kind of be the start of what everybody's waiting for.
Right. Liverpool's the other team that beat them this season beside Arsenal. Right. When they lost to Liverpool last month, at Liverpool, the thought was, okay, here we go. And I think people had expected that swoon to start before when they went to Everton the previous week, and they beat Everton 3-2 at Goodison, another indication of the fragile defense of Roberto Martinez's side. But so then the expected swoon was going to come, and it never came. They drew with Manchester City, as you mentioned, which was a good point for them, good point for both teams. They drew with Bournemouth in a game where Riyad Mahrez missed a penalty, and then they found they started winning games. I think that this maybe psychologically for them is a game where they're going to want to get at least a draw because they've lost to Liverpool previously. But if they get a draw in this match, they're still top of the table going into that clash against Manchester City on the following Saturday. I really believe, and I've said this now a couple of times, I've even written an article about it on another site, that I believe that Claudio Ranieri is going to insert another midfielder, whether it's it could be Matty James, it could be Gorkhan Inler, it could be anyone, right? Mm-hmm. It could be Andy King, right?
Yeah.
In the games at Arsenal and at Manchester City,
he's going to choke
down the play, go with Vardy as a single striker, and I can see them getting results in one or both of those matches. And again, if they get draws, okay. Let's say they get draws in all three games and they're on 50 points, and in the same period, Arsenal takes 7 points and Manchester City takes 7 points, and they're both ahead of Leicester entering the stretch of games after that, I think it's advantage Leicester in the title race because they've survived that stretch and they've got the much easier run-in. So the only way I'm thinking Leicester falls out of this title race is if they lose all three of these matches, and I just don't think they're going to.
They might, but there's no reason for us to think that based on how they've played
this year. Right, they've only got two losses this season in the league. So I heard it again in the last week. Well, that's nice. It's been fun, but they've got these three matches coming up and they'll be out of it after that. I don't know why we keep making these assumptions. We're making it based on history, and I'm as into history, Richard, as you know, anyone is. But this season is different. This Leicester team is different. They've got a big club manager, too. Nigel Gibson's not managing them. They've got Claudio Ranieri, whose track record, his pedigree, you can laugh about his stint at Greece, but that's international form. I don't think that's applicable. You look at his record as a club manager, and it's pretty darn good. So I don't expect Leicester to fall away, and I don't expect them to this game on Tuesday, and I don't expect them to fall out of the title anytime soon.
If I were a Leicester fan, I would be far more concerned about the draw against Bournemouth and the draw against Aston Villa, because those seem to hint...
Were games where Mahrez missed penalties in both games.
Right. But those seem to hint that Leicester now needs to find another gear to deal with these teams that are going to treat them as recognized favorites. And that's not something Leicester had to deal with during the first half of the season. But it's something they're going to
The Bournemouth game was very surprising to me, because Bournemouth has tried to play with even the better in the league. And the Leicester game, they sat back.
Mm-hmm.
And they were unlucky not to get a goal on the break a couple times in that game. So that's a good shirt. I think the Leicester teams now... The teams further down the table are viewing Leicester as a top four team, a top six team, one of the better teams in the league. Now we can't let them sit back and counter us. We need to approach games differently. So maybe that's something to think about after they get through this three-match stretch. But all three of these teams that we're talking about are going to come after. Liverpool will, and certainly Arsenal and Manchester City will. So we'll see how this goes.
Let's talk about the specific matchup, Leicester City versus Liverpool. You mentioned Liverpool winning the reverse fixture at Anfield. So that prompts a question we should probably ask about almost any game in the second half of the season. Why should this one be different?
I think you're looking at a Liverpool team that is inconsistent, that still doesn't know their best side. Obviously, they came really good in the second half against Norwich. They've had two games since then. We talked earlier in this podcast. We spoke about the rotation for the FA Cup, but their best team did play a cup match and had to play 120 minutes against Stoke. They didn't look particularly incisive in that game. So I really think that this is a situation where they still have a lot of question marks in Liverpool. You're not sure where you're going to consistently get reliable goal scoring from. And the reality is Leicester hasn't given up a lot of goals lately. Leicester's goals allowed total is still high because of earlier season. But I'm under the impression at this point that we're going to see a good defensive effort from Leicester, and they'll get at least a draw. And I think one of the things that Liverpool has to be wary of is they still have on the back line, left back, Mahrez will be switched to the right side, or will be playing on the right side, and you'll have to mark him, you'll have to deal with him. Mark Albrighton is very good on the left side, so you're not going to want Nathaniel Clyne to get lost and commit too much to the attack. And their central defenders going up against Vardy and Okazaki, that's not a good matchup. No. That's not a favorable matchup any way you look at it. I don't, whether it's Colatore or Sakho, or now Stephen Caulker is with the team, I think if I'm Klopp, I'm probably going to stick with Torre. I mean, I don't want to take the chance of Caulker in this game, but maybe
Caulker's just an emergency striker. That's all he is.
right. Which seems to be the reason he was loaned to Liverpool. So I don't know. I really, even looking at the matchup, think that Leicester's going to create chances. They're going to create opportunities, and they're going to get goals, which means Liverpool is going to have to answer with the goals of their own. One more point, and I know I've made this on previous shows. Leicester, even when they struggled in those games against Aston Villa and Bournemouth, when they didn't get the results, and even when the goal scoring disappeared, the play, the movement, the counterattacking decision making on the ball, playing the right pass, that sort of thing never changed. So I haven't actually seen any discernible drop off in Leicester's play. Whereas I have seen discernible drop off in both Manchester City and Arsenal's from other points in the season. Now, the results have changed at times for Leicester because they haven't gotten those goals, but their level of play has not dropped off the entire season. We can't say that about any other team.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. When you watch Leicester play, Jamie Vardy is still working his ass off and creating chances. And the difference is we've seen Drinkwater miss some easy chances. We've seen Mahrez miss some easy dead ball from the spot chances. And we've seen Jamie Vardy not finish the way that he did over his first couple of months of the season. But the play itself is still there. And where that's relevant to Liverpool is, going back to what I asked you, is the differences in Liverpool between that confident team that beat Leicester and was still riding that initial wave after Klopp came on board, and now it's not only in that lack of confidence, But they don't have Martin Skrtel. Dejan Lovren has been injured. Felipe Coutinho isn't back. James Milner is having to play that hybrid forward, covering so much ground on that side role that we've seen him play very well. But it's one thing to play that against teams that don't have wingers. It's another one when you have Mark Albrighton that you're going to have to track all day. Is Milner going to be able to do that as well as help a team that struggled to get goals? It still doesn't have a forward that's reliable as far as goals. Even though Firmino has had his moments, is he going to be able to do that dual role?
Yeah, I think that this is a real concern for Jurgen Klopp. Then if you put in Christian Benteke, he might get you a goal, but his energy level, his work rate isn't good enough to play against a team like Leicester, for sure. And you've got a situation also in this match where Conte has continued to be this dominant midfield player, winning the ball. He and Drinkwater have such great understanding of each other's movements and each other's games. And I really am at the point where I think that if you don't have an additional midfielder, or you don't do something to take Conte out of his game, then your chances of beating Leicester are minimal. And he has been, I think, we've talked a lot about Mesut Ozil on this podcast, but I think Conte, as the season goes on, I really look at him as maybe the single most influential player in this league. And that's saying a lot. It's a guy that was playing in Liga 2 a year and a half ago. It was another player that Leicester found, that they identified through their scouting network, a very kind of robust statistics and other metrics in addition to actual, but they don't substitute that entirely for seeing a player play. They still do the basic scouting, but then they enhance it with statistics and with other metrics, not necessarily player stats. This is how they found Mahrez. This is how they found Conte. It seems to be working.
Yeah, as much money as other teams and leagues appear to be wasting, Leicester appears to be getting more efficient about bringing players in. I think that's a great point regarding Conte, but overall, in general, I think Conte epitomizes this. I think there's a confidence that this Leicester City team seems to have, having made it through that December stretch where so many people were predicting they would come back to earth when they were facing Chelsea and had the fixture congestion. You alluded to the Liverpool game. And they've obviously not only survived that, they're in a stronger position now than they were entering that time. I think the attitudes between these two teams have gone in a different direction. At the same time, I guess I don't know how to pick this game, Carter, because with Liverpool, I'm always expecting it to click at some point. I think so much of what has happened to them over the last 2 months has been a product of fitness and fixture congestion. Neither of those two things have actually cleared up that much, but maybe a full week of training the first team on a regular schedule, which involves the rest, the preparation, the continued adjustment to Klopp's system, maybe that could make a difference here for Liverpool. Even though they did have a match midweek, maybe the people that didn't have to worry about that match are going to be able to be fresh at the King Power Stadium.
Yeah, that's certainly very possible. I mean, I'm expecting Liverpool to click at some point also, even though I mentioned that I don't believe that their results in the league matter this much this season. They still don't want to finish 15, which would be a catastrophic disaster. I don't believe they finished lower than eighth in the Premier League era, so which was under Kenny Dalglish a few seasons ago. So obviously these are the types of games where you want to start getting results and you want to start getting some confidence, and they very well might. I think that a draw is probably a very safe pick here. As far as Liverpool clicking at some point, that's going to be important for guys who are looking to stay with this club beyond this season, because I think there are a number of transfer targets that Klopp has identified, and now he has seen 3 games in the FA Cup where the young players have gotten him through, gotten him the result he needs, and some of those guys might be integrated in the first team squad next season. With that in mind, the guys that are playing regularly on the first team and the Premier League and also now in the League Cup final, they're going to need to step up, and they're going to claim their spot where they're going to be replaced.
Interesting game, a lot of good angles, and it's all going to be decided by a Simone Mignolet error, of course. And when it is, Kartik and Nipun Chalpada are going to be back midweek to review this round, as well as look forward to the next one as I continue my mini vacation. But for everybody that is not on vacation at the World Soccer Talk site, in the World Soccer Talk family, for Lawrence McKenna, who was out this week, Nipun Chalpada, I'm Richard Farley. Kartik?
Richard, you're on mini sabbatical, but even you are enjoying your football during this break, and thank you for joining us this Sunday. You broke your little vacation.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737. Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast. And Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email. Richard@worldsoccertalk.com.